Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Legatum Institute, part of the Legatum Group, which, headquartered in Dubai, spans the world with its intellectual, cultural, philanthropic, and business energy. Whether directed towards MIT, where the Legatum unit studies entrepreneurship, whether in sub-Saharan Africa, where the END Fund and other global funds fight the good fight against the steady rise in slavery in its modern form, and also fighting the necessary fight against the spread of disease in the form of the End Neglected Diseases campaign. And so too the Legatum Institute, whose activities are both extraordinarily diverse and wide-ranging under the general banner of prosperity. Our concern is to analyze the origins and nature of free market prosperity, but also the cultural energies that are associated with that dynamic movement in the history of mankind and whose creative energies are visible all around us in the contemporary world. As the senior advisor at this institute, it's part of my very happy duty to look after the Cultural Prosperity Programme. And this evening marks the inauguration of the Roads to Freedom series, part of that programme. There was a time when it was thought, just after the collapse of the Berlin Wall, that freedom's advance would be almost ineluctable, whether in the field of economics or in the domain of political values. But a more sober recognition of realities counsels us that over the past couple of generations, there have been very significant obstacles placed in the pursuit of freedom. And this lecture series looks at the nature of some of those obstacles and how practically they might be removed. And so, to this evening's speaker, who proposes a very fine, very radical, accurate analysis of the nature of linguistic threats that have arisen on the roads to freedom in recent generations. Simon Heffer's career has enjoyed spells of great distinction in Fleet Street, editorial positions at The Spectator, Daily Mail, and Daily Telegraph. But he's not just one of those journalists who is, as it were, offers us a steady or daily immersion in the politics and theatre of the moment. He also has enormously wide range as an historian and commentator, as biographies of Enoch Powell, for example, and of Thomas Carlyle have offered us, with a wealth of illustrative historical research. And in his most recent volume, High Minds, he takes us to the domain of the high intellectuality of the 19th century, a period that may indeed reproach some of the shadows of the present world. In Democracy in the English Language, several decades ago, George Orwell pointed out that the nature of modern totalitarianism was such that it debased the English language. And in The Nationalization of the English Language this evening, Simon Heffer will be taking up the cudgels in a new and informed manner on behalf of the language that is our shared possession. And he will be demonstrating to us, with a wealth of illustrative examples, I've no doubt, the way in which our language, our shared language, our common heritage, is under threat and what we should do about it. Therefore, to start unrolling back the boulders that we may encounter on the roads to freedom, ladies and gentlemen, I give to you Mr. Simon Heffer.
Thank you very much, Hal. The right to express oneself freely on matters of politics, conscience, faith, or philosophy, and without the prospect of recrimination or punishment by an authority that may hold contrary opinions, is an essential constituent of a free society and central to the idea of liberty. This is not least because such freedom of expression is a means by which to avert tyranny and to prevent the political class from concealing its actions and intentions indefinitely from those over whom it rules. Other manifestations of freedom are desirable, but without this fundamental right, they are largely vacuous. While it's agreeable for a citizen to have the choice between 20 different brands of tea or 30 different models of car, the consumer society is not quite the same as the free society. Choice is a mark of liberty, but not so vivid nor so indelible a mark as the right to speak one's mind. A civilized state, in the way a liberal society interprets modern civilization, will strenuously uphold its citizens' rights to articulate their feelings and beliefs. More important, as well as not punishing the expressions of opinion itself, it will ensure that others beyond the state do not restrict the right to freedom of expression either. Perhaps as important, though, are the lengths to which a benign and liberal state should go to ensure that its citizens are properly equipped to formulate and to articulate their views, and to ensure that media such as the printed press have the right to print views that disoblige the political class, and in which the political class has no statutory right to interfere. In both of those respects, as I shall argue in this lecture, the state is showing alarming signs of deficiency. In recent decades, we've seen the state in Britain limit what many of us grew up to recognise as the parameters of freedom of speech and expression. In the civilised and free society of which we dream, some limits have always been essential, even once we stopped punishing people for sedition. The last attempted prosecution, which was dropped, was in 1972. Long before that, in 1695, the state allowed the press to publish what it wished without the fear of criminal sanction, but on the understanding that certain civil laws would continue to pertain. There have long been laws of defamation affecting the written, spoken, and from the 20th century onwards, the broadcast word. The roots of defamation law can be traced back to the 13th century, and predictably, suits became frequent by the 17th century when the incidence of criminal sanction against publishers became less. A criminal sanction, very rarely used, remains to this day. If the utterance of a libel is deemed to endanger the peace or cause a crime to be committed, then the utterer may be prosecuted for criminal libel and be imprisoned. Those of us who subscribe to the idea of freedom of speech understand the fundamental rule that it must not be abused by telling wanton untruths about people and damaging them in the process. Telling the truth about others and being allowed to do so is, by contrast, a cornerstone of a free society, especially when there are truths that those affected would rather were not told. However, the limits on what one can say have in my lifetime increased incrementally. Fashions change, and with them change the idea of what does or does not constitute acceptable language. Far more insidious, however, is the mobilisation of sectional interest groups to seek to lead opinion, for whatever reason, to change the terminology it uses in certain contexts. These groups are exceptionally active in any forum where the rights and standing of minorities may be brought into question, not for the sake of preserving the rights of those minorities, but for the sake of allowing their spokesmen or women the opportunity to grandstand and make a political point. One especially regrettable departure, when it should be the aim of a free society to remove criminal sanctions from the statute book, is the trend by which forms of expression that used merely to be considered offensive, rude, or insulting are now considered criminal. It's one thing to limit expressions that might incite others to commit a crime, such as a violent assault, since prevention of crime and ensuring the safety of the person must also be considered to be among the foremost duties of an advanced state. It's quite another thing to bestow upon the state the right to protect, through so extreme a sanction as the criminal law, the hurt feelings of others. This is effectively what has happened with recent sanctions on language that the law deems to be either racist or homophobic, two words that have become almost lethal weapons in the hands of some zealots. No one would dispute that it exhibits racial prejudice to insult and attack, verbally or physically, a person simply on account of the fact that his ethnic origins differ from those of his assailant. But it does exhibit such prejudice. Sorry, but does it exhibit such prejudice, as one counsel suggested a couple of years ago, for a person to display an English flag in the window of his house just because the area in which he lived happened to be populated in large measure by people whose ethnic origins were not English? It's precisely because of this determination to criminalise the causing of offence, or rather the alleged causing of offence, that it is important to discuss the way we treat our vocabulary, or rather the way in which governments and self-appointed guardians of the public interest urge us to treat it. And it's a short step from penalising the causing of offence to attempting to marginalise or ostracise those who use language that's merely uncomfortable for the political class or for certain sections within it. Look at the determination of some elements in local authorities to prevent the use of the entirely inoffensive word Christmas and to substitute for it holidays or the ludicrous Winterval to avoid upsetting non-Christians, or rather for those politicians to pretend to certain groups of non-Christians whom they count as part of their clientele that they care so much about their sensitivities that they strive to imagine what those might be. I have never met a non-Christian who is offended by the use of the word Christmas, but I have met numerous Muslim and Hindu shopkeepers who have no difficulty in selling Christmas cards and Christmas wrapping paper at the appropriate season of the year. The cynicism of imagining that they would think otherwise is rather disturbing in what it says about the determination of certain elements to use language as a means to manipulate others. Let me furnish an example of the position we've reached with criminalising the causing of offence. When I was a child half a century ago, there were two words in the English language deemed so offensive that not only did one not read them in newspapers or hear them on television, but if one had used them in public, such as shouting either of them out from the crowd at a football match, one would have risked arrest and prosecution. Another deeply offensive word used to describe people of non-Caucasian ethnic origin was even then confined to the coarse and uneducated, but no policeman would have blinked had he heard it at a football match. Today, that word has become just about the most toxic in the language, so much so that even in an academic discourse such as this, I feel I cannot mention it, even for purely illustrative reasons. There are calls to prosecute those who do think it amusing to use it, as the television presenter Jeremy Clarkson will tell you. However, no one would today be prosecuted for public use of either of the other two words to which I've alluded, and one of them can be heard somewhere on British television every evening. Doubtless, before long, the other one will be just as ubiquitous. In truth, all three words are exceptionally offensive, and many people remain upset and offended by the use of the two words that were regarded as literally unspeakable from Chaucer's day almost to our own. But a free society has to be careful how it censures such things. Public opinion, and not the law, should regulate the use of language. I regret that the liberal idea of regarding someone who uses any of these words in public as an exceptionally low, crude, and ignorant person to be shunned and reviled by all decent people has patently passed. Instead, some feel we should put such an imbecile through the legal system, squandering public money and giving him an element of martyrdom among those just as vile as himself, and in all likelihood doing nothing to stop uncouth people such as him from behaving in a disagreeable way. What we're saying by criminalising the use of language is that we wish to infantilise our people and not trust them unimpeded with a precision tool of the English language, much as we would not give a five-year-old child a loaded revolver. But the infantilisation goes beyond the offensive man. We also, by criminalising such an expression, infantilise the public by guiding them towards what their response to and their level of disapproval of his language should be. I hope most of us know these words are disgusting without the law having to threaten us about any of them. But even in the present climate, which is not so much one of political correctness, as one in which individual pressure groups tend to work with the help of politicians and the media effectively to ban the use of words or phrases that they choose to dislike for their own purposes. Not every form of expression deemed offensive to progressive opinion can be effectively banned by criminal sanction. And when states have little choice, because of the force of public opinion, custom and practice, but to allow freedom of expression, they look for other ways to rein in that expression. Cunning members of the political class understand this, that it is all very well allowing freedom of speech, but if the language skills that the person exercising that freedom has are ill-formed, the effect they are able to have, particularly among opinion formers at whom their protests may be directed, will be diluted or discounted altogether. Language is the fundamental tool of civilization, and so states that wish to limit the effect of the thought of others on their particular polity will do what they can to control or restrict or shape its use. It's an essential target for those who would exert political authority in its most ruthless form, because it provides not only the means of communication, but the means of articulating thought. Some states wish to control thought and limit communication to protect the interests of a political elite, their often questionable policies, and the public's belief in the often specious narrative of their actions. By eroding people's abilities to use language through poor educational standards, a state or a culture erodes their abilities to think for themselves and to challenge forces greater than themselves. There are few surer routes to tyranny. George Orwell famously noted this point in 1984, in which a whole new language was invented to disguise the evil that the political class was doing and to restrict the ability of the people to question it. I'd be exaggerating if I have to say that this has happened in Britain since 1948, when he wrote his book, but I wouldn't be exaggerating by much. It's one thing to cleanse the language of terms that are considered harsh. No one today would casually refer to a disabled person as a cripple, which they would routinely have done until the 1960s. Later on, it was decided, usually at the initiation of interest groups active on behalf of such people, that we should stop referring to people with cerebral palsy as spastics or people with Down syndrome as Mongols. At one point, these had been the standard way to describe sufferers from those afflictions. But rather as with cretin and imbecile, they were hijacked as terms of simple abuse by schoolboys and others who revelled in the language of insult to use against others who had no such affliction. That shift of language was quite understandable and reasonable. However, in a further development of the vocabulary of compassion, we are encouraged not to say the disabled, the blind, the elderly, but to talk of disabled people, blind people, and so on. I have no wish to mock or belittle anyone with such afflictions, but this usage seems to me to lard the sentiment on in a way with which those of us who write about politics have become distressingly familiar in recent decades. It patronises speakers of English to assume they might forget that when they use an adjective such as blind, they do not realise it describes a human being. Emoting is something politicians today do far better than governing, but they should not make the rest of us prisoners of their cynical outpouring of emotion. It's quite another thing to change the vocabulary because the change makes it easier for a politician to defend something or to convince the public when making a difficult case. Before the welfare state existed, the payment given to the unemployed, or perhaps I should say unemployed people, was called the dole. That is what it had been called for centuries, the money literally doled out by the parish to support the indigent. Now we're told it is a job seeker's allowance, which conjures up the pleasant idea of a wealthy parent or uncle opening a crocodile skin wallet each week and handing out money as if of right to the beneficiary. It also seeks to condition the beneficiary and, more to the point, the taxpayer whose expropriations fund him or her to believe that a job is actually being sought, which is unlikely to be true in every case. Thus is language made a tool of propaganda and social conditioning. When Mr. Attlee invented the welfare state, the relics of the old poor law of 1834 were finally removed. a subsistence payment for those such as the elderly, the disabled, and widows who had no record of national insurance contributions became known after the Act of Parliament of 1948 that established it as national assistance. In the spirit of euphemism that was coming to shape state-driven language, this was a nicely ambiguous term that required it to be clarified whether the person was assisting the nation in receiving the money or being assisted by the nation. It was the latter. Of course, it was the taxpayer and not the nebulous concept of the nation that was doing the assisting, but that too is indicative of how socialist states choose to obscure reality with euphemism. But even that was deemed too demeaning in time. Politicians like to pretend that the assisted actually are nothing of the sort. And so in the 1970s, national assistance became supplementary benefits, with further distortions such as family income supplement. Benefits in other contexts are things earned in return for work. These benefits were not earned at all, but claimed by what had become a right. By manipulating language to condition both the recipients of these payments and the taxpayers who funded them to the belief that they are now in the natural political order of things, successive governments have institutionalised welfarism and the mentality of dependency upon the state that is now doing such harm to this country. The most effective means of robbing people of the ability to understand the manipulation of language is through the education system. Nor is the manipulation confined to the teaching of the mother tongue, but also across the curriculum in removing the encouragement of students to think for themselves. The combination of poor articulacy and the inability to have a mind of one's own is lethal to individual freedom, but highly supportive of a degree of tyranny. Socialist states have always aimed to regulate education, both in terms of content and standards, in the interests of social control. The less well-educated the masses are, the less they are capable of questioning those who rule them. Limiting their language education by teaching a certain demotic variant of the language, which may include incorrect grammar, words defined inaccurately, and a restricted vocabulary used as labels for certain thoughts, is a prime means of doing this. For that reason, certain political systems, not exclusively of the left, dislike educational institutions that they cannot control. That is why political elites so detest private schools. It's also why they hate selective schools, for creating an intellectual elite that must inevitably question those who oppose them, because that elite is trained instinctively to do so. Since the 1960s, the educationists' laissez-faire attitude towards language has disabled generations of schoolchildren. It has left them with language skills that render them inarticulate, incapable of personal advancement, but also incapable of articulating criticism of the state and standing up to the state. Once language is disabled, the articulation of thought becomes almost impossible, certainly in a credible sense. We're left with the man in the street hurling repulsive insults and not engaging in rational discussion. A century ago, it seemed we were approaching an age of true democratic participation, because we had an education system that ensured its products emerged with certain basic tools. We also had a culture that, not least because the higher incidence of educated people, had come to prize clarity over obfuscation. In the 18th and early 19th century, prose works were marked by complicated sentences, some of them more than 100 words long, divided up into clauses and subclauses. They in turn helped make up paragraphs that ran over printed page after printed page. By the early 20th century, in an age of mass literacy, where writing had become as much for the communication of ideas as for entertainment for a leisured elite, sentences became shorter and paragraphs concise, logically encapsulating a single thought. However, with the coming of total war in 1939, that began to change. A military and civil bureaucracy took over the country. The latter imbibed the jargon of the former. Official communications among government departments and to the public became couched in a private language that either intentionally or unintentionally excluded the public. One civil service mandarin, Sir Ernest Gowers, was so alarmed by this, not because he feared the manipulation of the public, but because he feared for the decline of the reputation of the civil service as comprising men, and in those days it was mainly men, who were classically educated and with precise minds, whose language reflected the clarity of their thought. He published his book Plain Words in 1948 at the height of the Attlee government, and just as Orwell was writing 1984, to try to turn back this tide and preach the gospel of clarity and precision. But he'd missed the mood of the time in Whitehall, which was, bluntly, to carry the public along with what the state was doing by using language that obscured the truth. An Orwellian distortion of vocabulary has taken place ever since, with the left predominantly influencing the terms we use to describe groups they consider to be their clientele and the activities in which that clientele engages. We've seen a recent example of this in an American-inspired campaign by feminists to ban the use of the adjective bossy in its application to women. They argue the term is sexist, itself a word created by the new police of our language and thought, because it is, they say, usually applied to women and not men. Anecdotally, I suspect everyone in this room has at one time or another heard a man described as bossy, or even used that term to describe a man. But let us leave that to one side. What is frightening here is the ability of a small group with wealth and celebrity to be hijacked by the politically motivated into excluding a word from polite, rational discourse. Scarcely less frightening is the willingness and ease with which other groups will identify with this censorship. For let us not mince our words, that is what it is, and seek further to promote it. Of longer standing is the patronising inclination of the middle class left to endorse the proletarian usage fall pregnant, a form that removes from the act any sense of deliberate behaviour, a woman becoming pregnant by much the same chance as she might fall ill with a cold. Another example of the abuse of language, a grave abuse, but one that went largely unnoticed to the extent that even intelligent people found themselves committing it, came at the time of the financial crash of the autumn of 2008. It's unsurprising, I agree, that at a time when a great international bank, Lehman Brothers, had crashed, and there was widespread fear of other such institutions going the same way, people should be in a state of unease or even of panic. And therefore, they should not perhaps be so careful as they might be in less hectic times about their use of language. Yet it's inevitably at such times of heightened tension that it's more important than ever for people to think hard about the terminology they're being encouraged to use. For it is at such times that those who bear responsibility in some or in part for such catastrophes manipulate language in an attempt to shrug off their culpability and to place it on the plate of somebody else. Banks were at risk of collapse here and abroad for three conspicuous reasons, two of which were the direct responsibility, in Britain at least, of the government. First, some idiotic commercial decisions had been taken when it came to making acquisitions of other businesses that were insanely overpriced and for which due diligence was not done. That was not the government's fault, but it's something the executives, soon to be ex-executives, of the businesses concerned would have every reason to want to conceal their part in. What was the government's fault was the ridiculously lax regulatory regime that it had instituted in 1997, and which had allowed reckless use of shareholders' and depositors' money, and the excessive liquidity in the system caused by lax attention to the money supply, which caused numerous banks to make loans that a previous generation of bankers would have considered highly dangerous. When their collapse came, when the British government had to part-nationalise two banks to prevent them from going under, the phrase that was minted to describe what had happened was market failure. It sounds a lot better than reckless stupidity, or stupid recklessness, so one can understand why. But in logic, the phrase does not work. What is a market? It's a meeting place of buyers and sellers. At that meeting place, which may be concrete or abstract, buyers have to come to a decision of whether to buy and at what price. And sellers have to come to a decision of whether to sell and at what price. Some of those decisions, whether on the part of buyer or seller, may be wise. Others may be foolish. Manifestly, in the run-up to the crash of 2008, more bad decisions were taken than good ones, greed triumphing over prudence. And the triumph was permitted not least by failure of regulation. The phrase market failure shifts responsibility away from the government, in that instance a Labour government, whose relationship with the idea of free markets had, at best, been one of exigency and convenience, rather than of deep conviction. And a phrase which, when unpicked, reveals itself to be meaningless, is one that allowed some of those who bore serious responsibility for the crash to escape proper scrutiny. Worse, it also helped prevent those who bought the concept of market failure to learn a valuable lesson about what really happened and how it might have been prevented or at least mitigated. One of the legacies of that crash has been a long period of economic reconstruction, itself far from complete even now, 6 years later. In an attempt to stimulate economies that lacked confidence in capital, advanced economies including Britain and the United States have been printing huge quantities of money. However, the authorities who have undertaken this activity have declined to term it as such. They call it quantitative easing. It rather spoiled their game when, on the launching of this specialist coinage into the non-specialist world of ordinary people whose living standards had been compromised by the crash, the media decided to explain what, in layman's terms, it actually meant. So they announced it meant, as I've just said, printing money. That put a somewhat different complexion on the policy. It resonated with memories of Weimar Germany, of Argentina before its default just over a decade ago, of Mugabe's Zimbabwe, the Weimar of our times. Thanks to a free press, more of that in a moment, the public were left in no doubt of the demeaning, debauching policy that political and financial mismanagement had forced upon their country. Phrases such as quantitative easing began harmlessly enough as jargon. They were used by people in the world of finance among themselves to show that they were all members of the same club and to show off their MBAs and their place on the payroll of what were once considered elite financial institutions. But what began as harmless self-aggrandizement soon became something more problematical, euphemism. And when euphemism becomes the rule, it ceases just to be a problem and becomes rather dangerous because it becomes downright deceit. When the press explodes such euphemisms or deceptions, it makes enemies. It comes hard up against the resistance to being held to account that's become distressingly common to all parties when in government. The question of how to regulate the press remains, as far as the government is concerned, unresolved. The press itself has constituted a new self-regulatory body, the Independent Press Standards Organization, which will seek to impose sanctions on newspapers who break its code of practice and reward those who behave responsibly by allowing them to display a mark indicating their compliance. The government, however, reserves the right to activate its own royal charter, which provides a framework for statutory regulation, and which, so long as it remains in existence, potentially allows a future government, perhaps one determined to intervene in the conduct of the press and to regulate what it may or may not print, to introduce draconian sanctions on newspapers and magazines, and possibly a form of preemptive state-supervised censorship. The present Prime Minister established the Leveson Inquiry in 2011 to explore matters of press regulation. Ostensibly, this action followed the accusations of serious wrongdoing at newspapers owned by Rupert Murdoch, one of which, the News of the World, was summarily closed down. Some of those accused of the wrongdoing are on trial, and others await it. That trials are proceeding proves that the existing law is sufficient to deal with press wrongdoing, whether the allegations be about phone tapping, intercepting messages, or seeking to corrupt holders of public office by supposedly offering them bribes in return for information. The printed press is also subject to the law of libel. The inquiry under Lord Justice Leveson was unsatisfactory in many respects, not least that it required the participation of many of those who would subsequently come on trial, and who, as such, were unable to prejudice their cases by giving detailed information in response to the questioning of the inquiry's lawyers. The Prime Minister acted in response to a clamour from politicians and pressure groups to have the existing state of press regulation examined. What, though, was behind that clamour? If it was the fear that criminality was rampant in parts of our national press, and two journalists had already been imprisoned for intercepting communications in 2007, then it was a legitimate concern. However, the terms of reference should have been precisely drawn, and they weren't, resulting in an examination of the ancient history of journalism in Britain. The correct finding would have been that where there was outrageous behaviour by journalists, the existing criminal law and the civil law of defamation were already sufficient to deal with the problem. The inquiry instead recommended a form of press regulation that had a statutory underpinning, representing the first intrusion by the state into a free press since 1695. As I've said, the present government chose to establish a framework through a royal charter, but not yet to activate it. Perhaps that's because it realises that such an intervention would have to stretch back 320 years to the era of hanging, drawing and quartering, public floggings, the pillory and the stocks, for a precedent in English practice for what it proposed to do. Perhaps it understands what an imposition on the public's liberty and what a countermanding of the idea of freedom this would be. And perhaps it's also sensitive about one other point besides, that the motivation of many of those politicians who want statutory regulation and the end of a free press was not the alleged criminality of certain employees of Rupert Murdoch, for which, as I've pointed out, a mechanism of investigation and punishment already exists, but something far closer to home. Perhaps their motivation to close down this singularly important freedom was the exposure by the Daily Telegraph in 2009 of the inflated, preposterous and in some cases criminal expenses claims of numerous members of Parliament. Had there been statutory regulation in 2009, would that story, which was undeniably in the public interest and which ran for weeks, have been allowed to be printed at all, or if it had, to run beyond its first couple of days? Or would Parliament, comprising so many members who had been made to look foolish by the Telegraph and by the rest of Fleet Street as it followed them, have found a means through the legislation to prevent the story from being printed? A combination of a state-regulated press and our present low-grade education system would be fatal for the future of freedom in this country. The press is not outside the law, and the present campaign against it springs from darker motives. And I'm sure that part of the sympathy part of the public feel towards the idea of state regulation can be traced back to the willful failure in our education system to teach people to think for themselves rather than to bear on their minds the impression of the last establishment figure or celebrity to sit upon them. It could not be more obvious to me that there is no care on the part of most of our educators to allow their students to acquire that most valuable of commodities, the mind of one's own. And anyone wishing to think for him or herself is hardly helped by being inadequately trained in the use of our language. And I must stress, this is not just in terms of acquiring the final polish that a correct understanding of grammar brings, but also that people should be taught what words really mean. Our language is a precision tool, and one immensely useful in protecting the freedom of the individual against the oppressive state. Used properly, it enables men and women to challenge authority, to question it, and to resist manipulation. In a world such as ours, a civilized state promotes and develops the skills required to maintain our liberty and its values. I long for our own to recognize this.